It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There are issues with modern food journalism, from payoffs in free food to the disappearance of fact checkers. So what does the future hold? Well, here's Chris Schoenberger, editor-in-chief of First We Feast.
You know, I think the future is more diverse voices who are capable of telling stories that maybe journalists in the food space have traditionally stumbled with, because let's be honest, it's not the most diverse group of people. It sometimes looks like a liberal arts school homecoming instead of the type of newsroom that would really engender excitement about all of the stories that we should be telling.
The future of food journalism and a Vietnamese pop star turned banh mi mogul. Lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The problems with food media that nobody wants to talk about. Well, that's a blog post that recently got my attention. It's from First We Feast, written by Chris Schoenberger and Justin Bolus. It tapped into what we've seen happening. Some downright laziness in recipe writing, as in the recipes don't work, not getting the facts straight, not to mention certain restaurant critics accepting free food and favors from the very places about which they're supposed to be doing unbiased reviews. Now, mind you, the food media is populated with a lot of genuine pros, but the question here is, who to trust? Well, here's one take. In addition to co-authoring The Problems with Food Media, Chris Schoenberger is editor-in-chief of First We Feast. Chris, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why do you think that the mainstream food media, you know, the big websites, the food magazines, newspapers, TV, why do you think they're not writing about the food issues that concern a lot of people?
You know, I think there's, you know, that's a huge question. And of course, I don't have all the answers, but two main things that I see time and again is one that, you know, as the publishing landscape has changed, budgets have contracted, a lot of food magazines have sort of been focused grouped into being something that is more sales driven, as opposed to a magazine that sort of, you know, was one of the great food magazines to ever exist, Gourmet, whose mandate extended beyond recipes, beyond cooking, to social issues. You know, the problem with slave labor around tomatoes, people like David Foster Wallace writing about lobsters. So, you know, without those budgets, but also without that mandate and that ambition and support system to pursue stories like that, they're never going to happen. Now, another huge part of what we're seeing in food media now is, of course, driven by the pressures of the web. And that's something that I'm more intimately experienced with, having written a lot for the web. And no matter what people's drive is, at a certain point, if they're publishing on such intense deadlines so quickly, chasing the dragon of, you know, search engine optimization and page views, you're just naturally going to have a race to the bottom at times.
Yeah, one of the things that concerns me that I see a lot of is incorrect information. Mm-hmm. The digging seems to have lessened, because often magazines and other entities will have people who do nothing but read through a piece before it's published and check and call the author and say, you know, what do you mean by this and where can I find information on that? And I wonder if they've gone on strike or there are just not as many of them. And, you know, this to me is very disturbing because there's so much lack of good information out there.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when budgets atrophy, the first two positions to go are fact checkers and copy editors. Mm. And that's a huge shame. And it causes a lot of problems, a lot of sloppiness, a lot of misinformation. But the reality is that those two steps make things slower and they don't move at the pace of the web, which is everyone wants to be first. Everyone wants to get their story on Facebook before the next outlet. So it's a really rapid pace. You know, it's like a game of telephone, but for web journalism. If a misstated fact starts somewhere, the next story might have two incorrect facts. The next story might have three incorrect facts, and it snowballs and snowballs and snowballs, which is why you see people, you know, coming out all the time, and now they have a direct line to their audience through Twitter. You know, celebrities are always correcting the crazy stories that come out about them.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other things that you make a strong point about is that the food media is soft.
You know, when I said food media soft, I think it's that people are holding back their opinions that I know that they have. And I guess I was frustrated that I don't see that on the page as much as perhaps I would like to. And I think that readers would love to see it. And I think it's symptomatic of a food media that has an awkward relationship with the subject that it covers. And there's not a clear line between whether this is boosterism and trying to, you know, continue to convince the public that food is art, you know, chefs are the new rock stars, or, you know, show people when the emperor has no clothes and ask the right questions about food and restaurants.
Is this because people want to make sure they have access?
I think access is a big part of it. You know, listen, it's a pretty small world. Food in New York is a bubble, and then you take that to other smaller markets, and it's even more so. So even if there's not overtly unethical things going on, like pay for play, you know, where someone's giving you handouts to write a good review, which is more something you see at like the bottom end of the blogosphere as opposed to legitimate outlets, there's still a reality of the fact that all of these writers and editors and chefs are at the same parties, you know the same people. And I think people are a little bit hesitant to say anything that would get them kicked out of the club, so to speak.
Yeah.
And sure, it can feel good to go to a new restaurant and have the chef throw you some extra dishes and come say hello. But I'd like to think that journalists are more interested in telling stories that are going to help their readers make informed decisions than sort of living a glamorous lifestyle.
Goodbye to the free martinis. Chris, let's talk about money. Can people make a living these days as a food writer?
There are a lot of people making a living in food writing now, but it's becoming more and more difficult. And, you know, Amanda Hesser, who started a great site called Food 52, wrote an excellent piece in 2012 where she said, you know, if I'm really honest, I can't recommend people go into food writing anymore. You know, there's not enough pay at magazines and the business model doesn't support it. And as I said, I've seen people walk away from the industry. And I want to just say, I think it's really hard for young writers to come up in food media because the entry-level jobs are as low as $25,000 in New York City. You know, anyone who's at all familiar with living in New York City knows that that is not really enough to get by on. And there's an extra element that a lot of people don't see, which is in order to be able to write about food and be conversant in food, you have to go out and eat food. And there are not, you know, reserves of money at a lot of these places anymore to send people out to get educated and have the experience that's going to inform their writing. So not only do you have these minuscule salaries, but to write the stories that get you to the next small salary, you got to spend a bunch of it on food and drink.
So how do you see the future?
You know, I'm glad you asked, because while I think it's important to think about these things, I don't want to paint a negative view of food media, because I actually think it's an incredibly exciting time when, you know, some of the legacy brands are being forced to rethink what they are. Even more excitingly, there's a ton of energy coming in from, you know, younger editors and writers and new outlets. You know, non-traditional places are going to be spawning the next wave of media, and I think that's exciting.
Chris, you give me hope. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Chris Schoenberger is editor-in-chief of First We Feast and is co-author with Justin Bolus of The Problems with Food Media. To paraphrase Freud, sometimes a sausage is just a sausage. but not so when examined by Lucky Peach. The Irreverent magazine's editor-in-chief and co-founder, Chris Ying, conducted a survey of the world's most popular tubed meats in his new book, The Worst of Lucky Peach. And that's, you know, W-U-R-S-T. Our contributor, David Lead, who is admittedly sausage-obsessed, found the idea of a sausage compendium irresistible.
Welcome to the show, Chris.
It's great to be here.
So tell me, why sausage? What is it about sausage that made Lucky Peach and you write your first single subject book?
Can I be totally honest with you about this?
Of course.
A lot of things that we do at Lucky Peach sort of start as a joke. And when we were trying to come up with what our first subject would be for this series of single subject cookbooks, you know, I think this pun, the worst of Lucky Peach, occurred to me. Mm-hmm. And I suggested that as a book title. And from there, you know, we kicked around some other ideas but realized that a sausage book called the Worst of Lucky Peach was really the best idea we had. So that's why we decided on sausage to begin with.
Well, that's just as good of a reason as any. It's very Lucky Peach. And speaking of very Lucky Peach, this is not a traditional cookbook.
Yeah, it's not exactly a cookbook. We sort of imagined it as kind of a Lucky Peach issue gone crazy. but yeah, there's a lot of kind of essays and information and humorous bits and rants, and then a good number of recipes to go with it.
Well, I think it's great because you have all of these op-ed pieces or what you call rants throughout the book, which really give a lot of humor and a lot of voice to this particular topic of sausage. And as you were going through the book and writing it and collecting all the information from your contributors, what are some of your favorite international sausages?
each continent kind of has its own things that it's known for. You know, Europe being sort of the mothership of sausages, mm-hmm. from which so many of these other ones spring. You know, anywhere that colonialism has gone, basically European sausages have gone as well. So, you know, in Europe, you've got the Casa Craner, the cheese stuffed sausage from Austria, which is a favorite of mine, and mm-hmm. and in Thailand, you know, you've got your Isan sausages, which are these little tiny sour orbs that look as though they're cells that haven't fully split. Those are some favorites of mine, and you know, in America, I think I gotta say just the chili dog is kind of my favorite hot dog. I grew up with chili dogs. I think those were sort of my formative sausage experiences.
And as you and your contributors were basically globe-hopping writing this book, what are some of the must and must-nots that you fell upon and came up with when it came to sausage making, sausage eating, sausage cooking?
So sausage cooking, mm-hmm. can be sort of a delicate proposition because you've got this thing that is being held together by, in most cases, this natural intestinal casing. And if you're not careful, it can burst early in the cooking and you're going to mm-hmm. lose sort of all of the goodness of what's inside the sausage. That being said, they're also more forgiving than, I would say, a steak or a piece of chicken breast or something like that. So it's kind of just about being intelligent with your heat management when it comes to cooking a sausage. If you're going to grill it, say, you can mark it first. On a higher, hotter part of the grill, and then move it to the cooler indirect heat to sort of finish cooking gently and slowly and let all of those kind of fats and everything break down inside of the sausage.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about some of the do's and don'ts for braising sausage, also smoking sausage.
Braising sausage is a really underutilized form of cooking sausages. I think that people who are from Green Bay and have eaten brats will probably be more familiar with that method than the rest of the country. But, you know, we usually think about sausages as being cooked in a pan or over a grill or occasionally smoked. But when you braise a sausage, that is to say, you know, sear it briefly and then kind of nestle it in whatever aromatic herbs and vegetables, onions and alliums and things like that, and then kind of mm-hmm. cook it gently with liquid, you get this really entirely different thing. It's not a sausage that you kind of snap into and have the juices come out. It has the same effect as braising a pork shoulder or anything else like that. The meat kind of becomes this really soft and you know, succulent thing that is not how we generally think of sausage. And then actually once you've braised it, you can take it out, cool it, and then grill it to get a little char on there. But
and a little bit of a snap once
you a little bit of snapback in there. Yeah, but I find braising sausage to be such a thing that not enough people are doing. Smoking sausages, for those who have access to a smoker or have the patience and wherewithal to set up some indirect heat, is amazing too, and I think is an art form that's probably best practiced in Texas, in hill country barbecue establishments. At least that's where I've had my favorite ones. But when you're making a sausage, you're basically recreating this cut of meat, you know, and you're using these cuts of meat that have lots of collagen and things in common with slow cooking cuts. Mm-hmm. These sort of indirect smoking or braising, break these down really slowly and gently, like I said, just like a pork shoulder or a pork belly or, you know, a lamb shank or something like that. So you get this very different but equally delicious end result.
So what is the takeaway that you would like people to have when they pick up the worst of Lucky Peach?
With sausage making and you know, being able to kind of dictate all of the terms of what your end result are, mm-hmm. I find it to be such a rewarding process. And we provide the instructions for making your own sausage and for what to do with them. You know, we don't want people just singeing their sausages on the grill. So, yeah, I think there are aspects of sausage making and sausage cookery that are sort of unexplored, and I would like for people to go out there and try them.
Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure speaking to you about the worst of Lucky Peach, and we'll hope to see you soon.
Thanks very much.
Chris Ying is author of The Worst of Lucky Peach, A Treasury of Encased Meats. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. And Chris left us with a classic, Pigs in a Blanket, and it's at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we meet the Vietnamese pop star who is also the queen of Vietnam's ultimate sandwich, the banh mi. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What do Jimmy Buffett, Jay-Z, and Kenny Rogers have in common? Well, they've all parlayed their fame to sell food in restaurants and chains. Now, how many celebrity restaurateurs can actually cook? Well, that's another story. Lisa Morehouse takes us to Orange County, California, where there's a sandwich shop run by the pop star known as Vietnam's Madonna, who is as comfortable behind the stove as she is behind the mic.
I'm in Westminster, California, in a banquet hall that's been converted to a club for the night. Linda Trung Dai is performing for a crowd that's dressed to the nines.
My name is Hong Nguyen.
And I'm Juliet Nguyen. We're sisters and we grew up in Alabama.
Down south, yeah.
They live in L.A. now, but they just had to make the drive out here tonight.
These were the big Vietnamese stars when we were younger, and we used to watch them on videos, and we'd go to their concerts whenever they did come down south.
The sisters say there weren't a lot of Vietnamese people in Alabama in the 80s.
There was only like 3 Asian in my school, and that was 2 of them were my sisters. So.
Tonight, Linda's wearing a barely there strappy outfit, which fits her image.
She was considered the sex symbol of our time, right, for a yeah. Vietnamese singer?
She was the Madonna, the Vietnamese Madonna. Yeah.
Linda Trung Dai loves that comparison with her idol, but she wants to be very clear.
When I'm off stage, I'm like 100% completely different. A total Vietnamese traditional girl who takes care of their family. Food on the table, everything.
Case in point, she started her sandwich shop as a business with her family. Linda Sandwich is in a nondescript building in the middle of a parking lot in a strip mall. But inside it feels like a posh living room. Lush plants, bright murals of Michael Jackson and Marilyn Monroe. There's also a wall of fame with framed images of Vietnamese American singers. Linda's at a back table. She sports stiletto heels, a short skirt, and perfect makeup, including false eyelashes. Patrick Pham is a customer here.
I used to like watch her in those videos with my parents when I was a kid growing up. So she's pretty famous among the Vietnamese community. I never met her personally.
I point out, the pop singer's actually at a table just a few feet away.
I know. Yeah.
The signature dish here is the banh mi sandwich with grilled meat, fresh and pickled vegetables, and pâté on a crunchy baguette.
I think like the whole baguette came from like France, you know, when they colonized this for 100 years.
More people of Vietnamese descent live in this part of Orange County than in any other place outside Vietnam. And though Linda Trung Dai's journey here was arduous, get her talking and it sounds like a food memoir. She grew up in the early 70s in central Vietnam.
I remember sitting on this wooden table. My grandmother even taught me how to make cơm bánh bèo, which is dough with shrimp on it.
A dish she still loves. After the war, her family went from well off to poor.
I would buy fruit, like I would buy the whole big watermelon, cut it up and sell it and make money.
And then in 1979, her father got tipped off that the government was going to investigate him on suspicion of aiding the CIA during the war.
So we escape on a boat.
At 2 a.m, the family split between tiny boats.
We had to be quiet. We were like so like quiet and just, it was scary. Because if we get caught, we go to jail.
They went through storms and ran out of food.
And then finally we went to one of the China Island and they kind of rescue us with rice and sugar. You know, it's strange to eat rice with sugar, but, you know, it was so good at the time.
They got back on the water, headed for Hong Kong, and then saw the large British ship that would save them.
We were, like, waving, and, oh, my God, I could never forget. It was just unbelievable, amazing, most amazing moment. And when we got up to, they rescue us, they give us croissant.
Eating that croissant was like going from hell to heaven, she says. But when her family got to the U.S., she developed another passion. And found her first career. It's a long story, but she went from high school performer to household name, singing with a popular variety show, Paris by Night. She became a huge star. In the 90s, in any home throughout the Vietnamese diaspora, you'd probably find a VHS tape featuring Linda. The videos even got back to Vietnam.
Back then, the people in Vietnam, they have to hide it. It's illegal to watch it. And if they get caught, they would be fined or go to jail.
But an estimated 72 million people did watch them there. Even as Linda started touring Vietnamese communities around the U.S. and the world, food remained central. The first time she went to Australia,
I just brought so many different kind of Vietnamese food from here on the plane. Banh bao, and I even brought this soup noodle, bún bò Huế.
She asked the flight attendant to heat it up for her. But she found good Vietnamese food all over the world and started a kind of ritual.
Any city I would go to, I would check in at the hotel, throw my luggage, and go find Vietnamese restaurant.
Other musicians encouraged her to start her own restaurant. And about 5 years ago, Linda Sandwich was born.
Hai xa xíu một đặc biệt.
A small staff does most of the food prep and sales, but Linda Trung Dai is still the only one to make a special Linda sauce that goes in the sandwiches.
This is my sauce maker. It's a mixer. Sometimes when I travel to Australia to sing on a tour or to Europe, I will be up all night here making sauce and sleep on the plane.
Anything, she says, for good food.
Vietnamese queen of pop Linda Trung Dai is the owner of Linda Sandwich Shop in Orange County, California. This story is part of Lisa Morehouse's series California Foodways, supported by Cal Humanities. It was originally produced for KCRW's Independent Producers Project. Now, you can assemble your own Vietnamese sandwich from this recipe for fried omelet banh mi from Asian Food Authority Andrea Nguyen. You'll find it all at splendidtable.org. The days of seaweed being eaten only in Japanese dishes are over. These ocean greens, and by the way, each one has a different taste, are answering the call for good tasting, good for the environment, and good for us eating. Think noodles, seasonings, and now, next to the Doritos, seaweed snacks. Chef Bart Seaver is on board with the plan. He's written a book dedicated to the cause. Superfood Sea Greens, a guide to cooking with power-packed seaweed. Our contributor Joe Yonan, food and dining editor of the Washington Post and a wannabe seaweed enthusiast, talked to Barton about how we can all learn to love the weeds of the ocean.
Barton, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Oh, Joe, it's such a pleasure.
Barton, one of the first things that I noticed about your book is that they're apparently not called seaweed anymore. Why is that?
Well, you know, people have such a taboo, I guess, against seaweeds. We see them washed up on the shore and, you know, we haven't developed a positive cultural association with them. You know, the Earth is 70% ocean and we aren't really exploring all that it has to offer there. And when it comes to sustainability, certainly there's so many issues that we're facing, from a lack of fresh water, lack of arable land, land use alterations affecting wildlife. I mean, all of these factors are really beginning to put a lot of pressure on agriculture. So there's a real reason there to push towards farming the seas. And so really when we're trying to rethink of seaweeds, ocean plants and ocean life as food, if we relate it to something people already understand, sea greens, well, then it automatically gives people an understanding of how to use them and even what they begin to taste like.
So, Barton, where should we start when we're trying to use more sea greens?
Well, luckily enough, you can start right at your regular grocery store, often in the international foods aisle. You can find bags of dried seaweed, most often two varieties. You can find dried kelp, sugar kelp, and dried dulse, which is a red seaweed. And they come in about 2-ounce packages. And to use them, you simply steep them in a little bit of tepid water to bloom them and to rehydrate them a little bit. And then the greens themselves are perfectly usable, chopped up, thrown into a salad, mixed with grapefruit and fennel, a little bit of spicy olive oil and some sherry vinegar. Whew, fantastic. Their flavors can be intense, but the beauty of them is really how they integrate into dishes, how they accentuate and highlight other flavors. Most of us are very familiar with sea greens in the form of miso soup or a dashi broth that, you know, accompanies every sushi meal that we've had. And so making a broth and maybe braising some chicken in that, chopping up some dried sea greens and adding it to a minestrone soup, you know, just adds such a wonderful little texture and this depth of flavor. And I think the key to this is not trying to hide the sea greens, but trying to gain familiarity with them through dishes that we're already comfortable with and that we already know that we love.
So I made this great dish out of your book, Barton, the Saag Paneer. It's that classic Indian dish of spinach with paneer cheese, and you add sea greens in with the spinach. Why did you want to combine those, and what other ways do you really recommend people think about cooking with seaweed?
Well, I thought about incorporating sea greens in the Saag Paneer because of that rich, deep-flavored spinach puree that becomes the sauce in which the whole, the cheese is all, you know, bathed and braised. I mean, wow, just what a great way to incorporate this other deep, rich umami flavor and it just accentuated with the coriander and the cumin and all the spices of that dish. It was just a fun way to meld flavors. That's one of the ways that I really look to use sea greens, you know, combining it with spinach and layering it into lasagna or creaming, you know, green beans with sea green stock, something like that, where you're really using it to accentuate flavors. But then there's also times when you use sea greens really as the main course, you know, on its own, where you're really looking to gain all of that flavor out of it. You know, I do like a collard style braised sea greens. You throw in some bacon, you throw in some onion, woo! Man, you keep it vegan, you throw in some smoked paprika and some onion in there, and what an incredible dish you have. And that really sort of represents the two ways of thinking about it. One is sort of a garnish and an accentuating flavor, and the other as really a main stage ingredient. And it works equally well as both.
And you write that there's more and more frozen available, and is fresh even possible?
Frozen is really, I think, where the market is going to go. Fresh sea greens, there are some difficulties with that as the product begins to break down fairly quickly after it comes out of the water. It needs to be blanched in order to stop that process. Plus, I think given the lack of broad market for it, I think a lot of stores are going to be hesitant to bring in a highly perishable product. So frozen seaweed, though, is in terms of culinary qualities, pretty much exactly the same as fresh. You really don't lose anything in the freezing process. And if you think about it, well, sea greens grow in terribly cold climates. I mean, I was harvesting sea greens and oysters up off the coast of Maine, and the seaweed was frozen. Well, it's meant to be frozen. The cellular structure stays intact, and so you end up with this beautiful, textured, full of flavor, vibrant frozen product that's as good as quality as you can get.
Barton, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Oh, Joe, it's a real pleasure. Always nice to reconnect with you.
Bart Seaver is author of Superfood Sea Greens. Joe Yonan is author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Now, Bart left us with a recipe for flatbread with butternut squash and smoked dulse. You can find it at splendidtable.org. And by the way, if you have any questions about the safety of eating sea greens, Bart recommends that you look for brands that are labeled with the names of the species and have been tested for heavy metals and contamination. Generally speaking, kelp varieties are going to be your best bet. Coming up, Chef Floyd Cardoza's perfect weeknight recipe. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to turn to your calls. Let's connect any way we can. You know, there's Facebook and Twitter, and there's the phone, 800-537-5252. Helena is calling from Scottsdale, Arizona. Helena, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. So I have probably 80 pounds of citrus that I've dehydrated in slices. About half of it's grapefruit, and I'm not really sure what to do with it aside from use it to, you know, steep in teas and things like that. And I'm hoping you might have some savory suggestions or tell me what I can do with all of this.
Well, one thing that occurs to me, if you're into cocktails, is steep a combination of them in vodka or gin. Mm. You know, one of those neutral flavored, you know, alcohols. And also, this could be so beautiful. You know, especially, you know, you could find one of those stoppered glass bottles. That's one thing to think about. And those would make great gifts, by the way. You know, you could even do jars.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, little canning jars. But, you know, what would be interesting to do, I've not done this, but if you have thick rinds on any of this, cut those away because they're going to be bitter. Mm-hmm. There is a dessert called Shaker Lemon Pie. And I think it came from the days when lemons had very thin skins because they just say to thin slice the whole thing. But thin slice, and you've got that already, remove the rinds. And the idea is you make a pie crust that's kind of rich and has a bit of sugar in it. Mm-hmm. And I always pre-bake the bottom crust very lightly, maybe 8 to 10 minutes. It's not totally baked, but it's dried a bit and it's going to stay a little on the crisp side. Anyway, once you've done that, you do layers of sugar and layers of the citrus, and you really pack it in. Don't totally overdo the sugar, but, you know, you want to have enough that you're not going to have any kind of sourness. Mm-hmm. And then you put a top crust on that, and you bake it. And I've not tried it with dried citrus, but I think it could really be interesting. The other alternative is to reconstitute it. But somehow I think the dried citrus is going to be really interesting. Boy, when you do this with fresh lemon, it is so delicious. And, people can't believe they're eating lemons. And in this case, I think you could have the whole variety, or you could just stick to one thing.
Wonderful. Now, I have another 20 pounds of citrus. Would you suggest peeling them and dehydrating the rind separate from the fruit for the rest?
You know what I would do? I would peel, just take a vegetable peeler, I know with 20 pounds, I'd say invite your friends over, steep what you've got in the gin or vodka, and do a lot of club soda or ginger ale with it, but I would peel the colored part of the rind off, and that's what you dry, because that is what you use in cooking.
Is there any kind of application I could use with meats or poultry or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You could chop up some of any rind. I mean, but I really think lemon and lime would be really interesting. And then what you could do is stuff a chicken with it and then roast the chicken, baste it with a bit of wine or cider, okay? And then what you do is when you make a pan sauce – you know, get the chicken out of the pan and all those juices in the pan. Throw in more chopped up flesh of the lemon and the lime.
Wonderful.
And it would be delicious. Wonderful. And one other thing you could do is do the same kind of saucing, but do it with anything that you put on the grill. And cook the lime or the lemon or whatever the citrus is in a bit of white wine. And then swirl in a bit of butter. And you can do that just in a little skillet. So whatever you've grilled, that's what you top it with. And a little sugar in there wouldn't be a bad idea either. You could do sort of a sweet tart thing. And that over fish or lamb or beef or chicken, anything that doesn't move too fast is going to taste better with it. And grilled eggplant.
Wonderful.
You know, think vegetables too. Grilled zucchini, grilled eggplant, sweet potato. All of those things would really take beautifully to a sauce like that.
You know, I've got a ton of zucchini, too. Thank you so much.
Oh, that the zucchini's going to love those things.
Great. Thank you.
So we're in envy mode here that you have all that wonderful citrus growing around you, but enjoy. And thanks for a great question.
Thanks so much.
Take care, Helena. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Boy, you know, if I could reach in out of my window and, you know, grab an orange or a lemon, that would be just wonderful. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. And Larry is calling from the Bronx in New York. Larry, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, hi, Lynn. It's great to talk to you. I'm calling. I'm a third-generation Bronx Italian baker here in the Bronx. My family has been running a bakery in the Bronx, and we're really very, very food-oriented. Our big one of the big things that my father used to always make was a puttanesca sauce. Used to make it here in the bakery. And I'm having my niece over, her and her fiance, for a dinner. And I wanted to do an evening around that sauce. And I was hoping that you might have ideas of other dishes that might be able to go with the puttanesca sauce.
Ah. Well, you're going to serve the pasta as the main course or the first course?
I was thinking of it as the first course.
Right. Well, first of all, let's think about it. Puttanesca has chilies in it, and it has, golly, I mean, depending on how you make it, olives and anchovies, tomatoes.
Right.
I mean, it's one of those things that is just so packed with all of these flavors, and some of them are the flavors of preserved foods. So there's saltiness and there's tartness. So what I'm thinking is, in some cases, I'd almost think I'd like to go not boring, but a little neutral.
Okay.
So one thing you could do is something really simple, like a lemon chicken, for instance, where you're roasting or sautéing cut-up chicken, and you're basting it with a combination of olive oil and lemon and salt and a generous amount of black pepper.
And what about like capers?
Capers would be great, but be careful because you're probably going to have capers in the – is your dad's recipe have capers in it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I think let the lemon speak because it's going to be very simple, but it's going to tie into the puttanesca. You know, it'll be a theme that'll it's like having a string and you're just going to keep hanging things on that string. But they're all related to each other. And with that, I think it would be fabulous to have something bright and fresh, like green beans, or if sugar snap peas are around, will you do a fast saute of them, and you do that with a bit of mortadella or salami in little cubes? Yeah. I think that would just be so – my mouth is watering thinking about that one.
Well, that would be great because we have shops in the area. I mean, our area has – I have a pork store in my neighborhood where they make their own soppressata and mortadella and all of that stuff themselves, and it's a great place for us to get these kinds of ingredients.
Larry, do you realize just saying pork store, my heart just beats – a little faster, because I don't think if you live outside of the area where you are or in the Northeast, you know that there are places where all they do is celebrate the pig and they, you know, and they're real butchers and they make all this homemade stuff and it's so good.
Well, that's what's great about our neighborhood. We have like three butcher shops, two fishmongers. We have a dozen different pastry shops and we have three bread bakeries in my neighborhood. So it's like I have this option to just shop in a bunch of different places, cheesemonger, you know, I just have everything.
Oh, Lord, you are lucky. Well, I think what you want to do is, and by the way, I think a green salad would be after, you know, after you can do another vegetable, but, and you could do potatoes. I don't care that you've had another starch because I think potatoes would be wonderful, especially if they're roasted so they're crunchy and crisp. So you've got a nice contrast. But I would do then a really tart salad, you know, with curly endive and a bit of escarole that you've really sliced really, really thin. So it's like, you know, it's like ribbons. And I would dress it.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and dress it, you know, do the classic dressing, which you probably were raised on, a bit of oil, a bit of good vinegar, and you're off. And then for dessert, I think it'd be great fun to have something really creamy. Like a budino, you know, a pudding, or something that you do with ricotta really – well, I'm going to say really good. You get great fresh ricotta. But, you know, ricotta maybe blended with whipped cream and a bit of espresso and a bit of chocolate and maybe a little bit of gelatin to hold it together. And you've pureed the ricotta so it's really creamy. And you could just chill that down in some sort of, you know, form. And then you serve scoops of that. With perhaps a bitter chocolate espresso syrup. Not super bitter, but, you know, bittersweet chocolate with a bit.
Well, I actually have something perfect for that, which is something that my mom makes for cookies. And it's made with chicory and honey and wine. And it has a little bitterness to it. And I save it from the Christmas holidays and I put it on ice cream.
Larry, I'm not going to ask you where you live because there will probably be people that are going to be outside your door. But do tell me this. What's the name of the bakery?
Oh, it's like my name, Adeo Bakery, and we're in the Bronx, in Little Italy of the Bronx. It's a wonderful place, and if you ever get a chance, if you ever come to New York, you must come and visit us.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to. And thank you for a great call that's made us all very, very hungry.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the ideas. It's perfectly perfect for us for this weekend. Thank you.
Enjoy the dinner party. Bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
I'm not going to wax, you know, I'm not going to talk for a half hour about Little Italy's and the treasures that are to be found there. But this is the reason why when you travel, if you can get into the local neighborhoods, you're in another world. It's like really like visiting other countries. You can reach us 800-537-5252. There's a lot of cookbooks written by chefs out there. Now, the good ones not only lure you into their pages, they send you straight into the kitchen. Chef Floyd Cardoza's book, Flavor Walla, Big Flavor, Bold Spices, A New Way to Cook the Foods You Love, did exactly this to our managing producer, Sally Swift. The hook? His recipe for an unusual and simple weeknight curry.
Hey, Floyd, thanks for joining us.
I'm so excited to be here, Sally.
So we love to dig into recipes that are simple and easy and are great for the weeknight. And leafing through your new book, Flavor Walla, I ran into a beautiful, beautiful shrimp curry with cauliflower, which is laced with turmeric, a little bit of tamarind paste, and coconut milk. And it is the most gorgeous yellow I think I've ever seen. Where did this recipe come from?
Everything I cook... you know, whether it's in my restaurant or in my home, has to have some kind of inspiration for me to cook it. This recipe, unfortunately, I just stole from my great-grandmother, my grandmother and my mother. So in India, this would be made when we went to Goa to visit our family. Mm-hmm. They'd make this with shrimp or a whitefish, and we'd have it with rice. But when my kids were growing up, it was very important for me to get them to enjoy the flavors I loved, the flavors that my wife loved, mm-hmm. because that's something that's really important to me. And I felt that if they had a connection to something that was my favorite growing up, they would enjoy it even more. And I created this dish because it's very simple to make. If you have the ingredients, you can get it done in, I'd say, under 30 minutes.
Absolutely, and all the ingredients are at a local grocery store. It's really exactly. quite simple. So I want you to walk me through this recipe, and let's start with the shrimp, because right from the bat, you ask for something that is a little bit uncommon for people. You ask for the shrimps to have their shells and heads on, if we can find them. Can you tell us why?
My mom used to make a quick shrimp stock, and she'd cook this for us with the heads on. The heads in the shrimp have this amazing flavor that normally gets wasted. The reason I use the shells is that when you take the shells and you put them in water and you bring it up, and you let it cook for about 30 minutes and you strain it, pressing out all the nice orange matter that comes out, the fat and all the flavor, it just makes your stock so much more flavorful. Now, if you don't have the time to do that and you buy them with the shells on, what I like to do is I like to keep the shells, I make the stock, and I save it in little quart containers in the freezer. So the next time I'm doing this, I have the stock to start.
So just to be clear, you are not cooking the shrimp in the shell. You're removing the shells from the shrimp, and you're making broth out of the shrimp shells.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's great. Okay, now the next thing you do in this recipe that I found really kind of interesting is you call for a whole serrano chili, but you don't chop it up. You cut it in half.
So for this recipe, just because it was for my kids who didn't like spicy foods, and this is a great dish to introduce people to spices. What I like to do is I like to put the chili pepper whole. I split it out in half.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the heat will go into the sauce, but most of the heat still remains in the chili pepper. So someone who wants to eat it a little spicier, like I did with my kids, I would take the chili pepper on my plate and eat it along with my food so I got the excess heat that I wanted.
That is so smart. So talk me through the rest of the recipe. So essentially you slice onions.
So it's sliced onions, it's minced garlic, there is turmeric.
A lot of turmeric, a whole tablespoon.
Yeah, because, you know, turmeric, besides giving it that wonderful yellow color that people associate with curries, mm-hmm. also has great nutritive benefits and health benefits. Like when I have a sore throat, I'll gargle with a little bit of turmeric. So I put turmeric in eggs, I put turmeric in sauces. It's an antioxidant, antibacterial, and it has this really nice aromatic earthy flavor that makes the dish really nice. And then I have cumin seeds, black peppercorns, I have the serrano chili, and I have tamarind paste. I do vinegar, I do cauliflower florets. Now, I love cauliflower, and you don't often see cauliflower with seafood dishes, you know, cooked together, but it's fairly common in the east coast of India, on the west coast of India. I also love putting cauliflower in this dish because my kids, I needed to get them to eat their vegetables somehow. And when you get this nice shrimp sweetness from the curry into the cauliflower, it just makes it really, really nice. And then I use coconut milk. And I start off with just, once I make my stock, I heat up canola oil and you can sweat out the onions and garlic. And then you add your spice. Now, it's very important whenever you're cooking spice to add it into oil because you're trying to extract the aromatic oils from the spice into your sauce. You add the chili, the vinegar, the tamarind paste, and the coconut milk, and you bring it up really, really slowly. Mm-hmm. And you put the cauliflower in first. You let that come up again and cook for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Then you add the shrimp in with the cauliflower in the coconut milk. You don't want it to boil, but you want it to simmer.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to cook the shrimp till it just you know, barely cooked. You don't want to overcook them because then they get tough.
Mm-hmm.
They're still soft. They're still delicious. They still have that sweetness in there, and then it kind of works with the tamarind, the slight bitterness of the cauliflower, which is not really bitter, but it has a counter. Mm-hmm. You know, the texture of the cauliflower just makes the entire dish so much more exciting because you have these flavors, you have these textures, and it's all balanced out.
I thought it was delicious. Floyd, it's a great dish for weeknights. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
Floyd Cardoz is author of Flavor Walla, big flavor, bold spices, a new way to cook the foods you love. Find that recipe, cauliflower shrimp curry, at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us today. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Julia Child. A party without cake is just a meeting. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Now, if you want to track down more information on anything you heard here today, head to splendidtable.org. You can register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, register for our monthly giveaways, find the perfect recipe for your Saturday lunch, and if you want to hear more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and better yet, subscribe. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.